It's the Full 48. Howard Beck, senior NBA writer for Bleacher Report. It is day 131 of NBA limbo. And I know you're already saying, Howard, but limbo's over, man. They're in the bubble. They're in practice. They're going to play soon. They're not playing yet. All right? Limbo's over when I say it's over. I'm the one who came up with this ridiculous, goofy counting shtick that I've been doing for the last few months. So I will wind it down and declare it over when the games begin. But that's 10 days away. We're close. We're very close to limbo being over. And here to help me jump into all the most relevant issues, but really with an LA flavor, because this whole NBA season was about LA, right? It was Lakers versus Clippers back in March. I don't know if it still is or not. I don't know where we are. I don't know what's going on. I'm not in the bubble. My guest is not either, but he is in LA, and we're going to figure this whole thing out. Dan Wieke, national NBA reporter for the LA Times. Welcome, sir.
Howard, I like your Al Gore, I invented counting. That's nice. That's bold.
I mean, I thought the world could use something to help us keep track of things. No?
Numbers are my shtick. They are mine.
Counting the number of days that we've been out of NBA games, I think that's my thing.
I think my thing is telling people about how much I'm exercising and then also eating a ton of food and drinking way too much alcohol. That's my bit. I've invented that.
Those are good inventions too, actually. Your inventions are more fun than mine, frankly.
Yeah, well, I got one beer, two beers, three beers.
I got to work on it. So we are speaking on Monday the 20th. We are 10 days out from this first scheduled games, which I assume are going to actually happen. We're this far in and nothing terrible has happened yet. Everything that we might have worried about going in, is there going to be a rash of cases right off the bat? Are people going to not show up? Are players going to bail? Are the cases in Florida going to be too much? Like, none of those things, like, they're all relevant questions and concerns, but none of those things have come to pass in a serious way as of right now. And I can't imagine, tell me if you think differently, and your colleague, of course, Tanya Ganguly, is in the bubble right now. I think you guys are going to tag team it later, or you're switching off. You'll go in, she'll leave. But there's no indications that anything is in jeopardy at all. Like, this is all systems go, right? There's no reason to think that there will not be games 10 days from when we are speaking.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think so far, right, like, the bubble plan itself seemingly is held up, right? The positive tests that came at the right time, if there's going to be a right time for positive tests, which was in the lead up to the travel and then, like, kind of in the very early stages of it, which is when you catch it. So that when you kind of set everybody free to roam around and go bass fishing and all of that stuff, that, you know, everybody is coronavirus free and in theory has no contact with anybody with the virus either, right? Like, so that's sort of the plan. I mean, look, I still kind of view this, and I've said this, like, on radio stuff in the past, but it sort of, like, still feels like the NBA is playing Jenga, like, on a waterbed a little bit, right? Like,
where do people, like, still have waterbeds?
I don't know.
Do those still exist?
So.
Okay. Anyway. Yeah. Jenga on a waterbed.
No, but, like, you know what I mean? Like, where the foundation of this is always going to be very fluid, and it's going to rock, and it's, like, you know, and it's hard. I mean, it's a really daunting challenge that the NBA has in front of them, which is to sort of essentially build a private world in which the things that are happening, I don't know what, 50 feet outside of it, don't get in somehow. Yeah. And I think that, so far, so good, you know, and they've thrown obviously a lot of money, a lot of resources at doing this. To me, I think maybe the biggest sort of wrench that could be out there is sort of, so very early on in this process, Adam Silver kind of was like, you know, the optics of, like, we're not going to feel comfortable taking all of these tests, all of this lab time if, like, the first responders and other people in the public, like, can't have it. Right. Like, this was sort of early on. I talked to executives about this, that in the immediacy after Rudy Gobert tested positive, like, I remember talking to one team president who said, you know, we could go buy 1,000 tests right now. Like, we have labs and stuff like that. But, you know, if the public find out that we did that while they didn't have access to said tests, like, that would be really bad for us and maybe would be bad long term business. It would be. And in addition to, obviously, like, the medical ethics of doing all of this, right? So my colleague Kevin Baxter just wrote a story in the Times. I'm not sure if it's been in print yet, but it was online, kind of about some of the problems that are happening in Florida, not with the amount of tests, but with the processing of tests, right? Where you have people waiting 6, 7, 8 days for results, which at that point, you know, why even take the test, right? And you've got two pro sports leagues currently, a third coming, that are getting tests, and they're getting, and it's imperative that these leagues have their tests done quickly. Now, the NBA says that they haven't put any additional strain on this stuff. They're using a private laboratory, A, and B, they've set up more resources. So they've actually, they say they've increased their testing. But look, we talked to the CEO of the BioReference lab, and he admitted, like, look, like, there could be a scenario where things get so bad, not dissimilar probably to how they were in New York, you know, earlier in this pandemic, where you have to throw all resources at the problem. And all resources would include the NBA and its testing. Like, so to me, that's kind of the thing I think that would make me most nervous, is that things would get so bad on the outside. Not that there would be, you know, an outbreak on the inside, that the necessary resources to keep everybody safe, would, it would look so unethical. It would be so problematic that they would have to say, like, we're going to have to pause this for a little while.
Yeah. And that's just kind of sitting out there looming. It may or may not come into play. The cases obviously are you know, alarmingly high as it is in Florida. And the as you note, the wait for test results for the general public is a problem. But until it's perceived to be a problem that pro sports are impacting, or that those labs could be commandeered by the government to relieve that pressure and that backlog, until that happens, I guess they're fine. And, you know, look, some of this is us, right? Some of this is media and fans deciding whether or not to raise this and press this as an issue. It's, you know, optics are about whether or not those of us who are viewing this literally think it's a problem. And I think it's a careful balance. And I think as of right now, everyone's kind of willing to kind of give them that room to keep going. But I don't know what would have to change on the ground in Florida, how bad it would have to get for that to tip. The other thing that occurs to me, Dan, and it's the place we don't want to go. We don't want to allow ourselves to go there mentally, but I will just note it, as morbid as it seems. Even if the NBA doesn't have an outbreak within its bubble, all it takes is one person getting really, really sick, whether that's a player or a coach or a ref or somebody else of any age group of whatever. If somebody has to be hospitalized from within the bubble, even if it's just one, and it's serious enough and it's scary enough, and I'm not wishing this by any means. I'm just, you know, like, we have the NBA had to consider all possibilities. We have to consider all possibilities as we cover this. If something's going to derail it, I think that is one of the other possible scenarios. I hope to God we never actually see that, but it's on the table, especially because you do have a wide range of ages and people in that bubble, way beyond just the players. So,
yeah,
but, you know, so far so good. I don't know how often you've spoken to Tanya. They just, the reporters, the 10 print reporters, I should say, there are ESPN and Turner reporters who are like on the TV side, but the 10 print reporters that were given credentials to go into the bubble just finished their quarantine. 7 days, seven straight days in a 300 square foot hotel room. No outdoor abilities, no ability to leave. No. In some cases, it sounds like they barely even had any natural light because their windows were small. It sounded like a mild form of torture. What have you heard from your colleague?
Well, you forgot the greatest injustice of all, Howard, and that's no Marriott points either for those 7 days, which is just like its own type of psychological torture for sports.
We can put up a lot. We can put up with an awful lot in our business for seven straight days if there are points at the other end and maybe a concierge lounge. With no points as the payoff, like, I don't even see how you even, like, justify it or maintain your
sanity. Yeah, no. I mean, look, I think, you know, talking to Tanya and texting with Tanya, like, yeah, I mean, I think she went a little crazy. I think everybody went a little crazy. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, the videos of Ben Golliver
from the Washington Post, you
know, walking back and forth from one side to the other. You know, Kyle Goon and his Instagram from the OC Register jogging in his room, running a mile and a half, like bouncing off the walls like the world's worst game of Pong. It sounds and looks terrible. And, you know, for me, like, as someone who's going to be going there in a month or so, or a little over a month, like, I mean, I'm anxious about a lot of different stuff. I am anxious about the quarantine.
Yeah.
Like, 7 days, no human contact, really. Not to mention, like, the stress of just, like, having your entire day built around a test, too, right? Like, where it's like you take the test, and then you have to wait for the results. Yeah. And there's, like, you know what I mean? Like, you can try to get lost in a book. Like, I'm sure I'll play video games or something, or, you know, I'll do work, or you can stream, or, hey, whatever you're going to do, right? Like, there's stuff you can do indoors. And I've figured out ways to like live on a couch for an extended period of time. Like I can do this, but I think it's like the anxiety to do that. Like every day, like, you know, there's a result that comes back that could dictate, you know, how much longer you're going to be able to do this or whether you're even going to be able to do this. Yeah. And I think there's a stress in all of that. Look, I think the fact that everybody's out now, you know, and they're out covering practices. I was just on a Zoom with the Laker beat writers and stuff for LeBron James was talking in. You know, he's taking questions from reporters that are there. And I do think like there, it just feels a little more normal than kind of the way we've been doing things for the last week. One thing that I know I'm very excited about is that we won't have to play this kind of silly kind of coach lie half speak about who is at these practices and who isn't, that there will be actually like real attendance taking.
Yeah.
Which is something that, you know, it's funny. I covered football, you know, this, I covered football for one season at the LA Times. I covered the Chargers. And I remember so much, like, I don't know a ton about, you know, football schemes and stuff like that. But one thing I do know is when you get to a practice, you take out the roster and you start looking for numbers. You start trying to figure out who isn't there. And I think like right now, I mean, look, I mean, we don't have rosters necessarily, or even a travel logs of teams. Like we don't know who went for every team and stuff like that. And I think we'll get a fuller picture of what teams did, you know, who teams brought, how many teams went like super heavy on medical, what assistant coaches, if there's some high profile ones, or, you know, like some things like that on certain staffs, who isn't there. And then obviously the players that are kind of been just sort of mysteriously not being talked about.
Yeah.
The Morrises, for instance, Avitz's, like the Clippers, they have a couple of them. You know what I mean? Having eyes inside a Clippers practice. So when Doc Rivers says, I don't know who's here.
Yeah.
Someone can be at the room and say, well, I do. I know who was there. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know. What have you made of that?
So the league and especially the Players Association, as I understand it, are very, very sensitive to not wanting to divulge or even hint at the possibility of player X being positive for COVID-19, right? And so because of that, if somebody hasn't shown up, then you have Frank Vogel doing his, we're not going to confirm who's here or who's not here or whatever, because they figure, well, if we say that somebody's not here and then they ask why and we can't say why, and then they're going to guess why, and the why might be the virus, but we don't want to violate the privacy by talking about the virus if they have the virus. So they've put themselves in this ridiculous box. And for a league that under Adam Silver has always been trumpeting transparency, I don't think it's a great look. I think whatever, we're 4 months after Rudy Gobert's positive test. And at that time, there was a lot of outcry about, and especially from people, agents and others, people who look out for player concerns, were saying, this is unfair to Rudy Gobert. It's unfair to Donovan Mitchell. It's unfair to Christian Wood or whatever. And never mind that some of these guys, I think, self-identified. Why are we still 4 months after the first NBA positive test and 6 months after the virus was in this country and we started talking about it on some level? Why are we still talking about this as if it's like a scarlet letter A? Why are we talking about this as if it's some mark of shame? It's a virus. It is a really bad and scary virus, and one that we're still learning about, and one that has caused, you know, all kinds of you know, havoc and death around the world. Having it does not reflect on you in any way, shape, or form. That the NBA, which ordinarily somebody has flu-like symptoms, they say flu-like symptoms. They have an upper respiratory infection, they'll say did not dress, upper respiratory infection. Sometimes I've seen gastrointestinal distress. I've seen all these descriptions. Why is this all of a sudden the dividing line, as if this is some intense privacy matter when every other illness or injury is simply spelled out? I don't get it. I don't think it makes sense. I don't think it's a great look for the league. I don't think it's fair to fans. I also think that for a league that is embracing gambling and wants to go further into that, and transparency is really important, I think that people are going to need to know when a guy's coming back, he didn't come back from, you know, a sprained thumb. He came back from a virus that in some cases can have impacts on you for weeks and months to come, which can affect your quality of play.
I think we've just kind of, or you just kind of talked yourself into why, obviously, agents specifically, right, don't want this publicized, is that there is a fear that positive tests, because of the questions about the long-term effects of this virus, that a positive test and a player with a positive test may see some impact in a negotiation.
Yeah. And listen, but they have to divulge when they had, you know, an ACL or an ankle surgery, right? Knees. So all these things
we know what an ACL recovery looks like.
Sure.
We know what an ankle you know, an ankle surgery recovery looks like. We know what hamstring, like all of that stuff, right? We know what an Achilles, we know timetables and stuff like this.
Yeah.
You know, like something I think right now where, you know, we don't know the effects on organs. We don't know the effects on where every day it seems like there is a new study that points in a different direction on this, because guess what? Like, this is the way science works, right? It's like science doesn't move quickly. Like, generally speaking, it's a slow, measured sort of thing. And the situation we're in right now says, like, no, like, hit the turbo. Like, we've got to move quickly. I just think there's so many questions about it that may be something. Now, look, I would like to think that executives in this league would not hold something that had nothing, that a player did nothing wrong necessarily, right? Like, these aren't necessarily guys going to COVID parties, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
Like licking flagpoles or whatever, like, you know, Kyrie Irving's not on the Brooklyn subway licking the ground so he gets it so he can have the antibodies. I don't think, you know, I don't know. Maybe you can you confirm or deny that?
That's
your neighborhood.
I haven't been on a subway since like March 16th or something. So,
okay. So yeah. So, I mean, I think like, to me, that sort of, I would like to think that executives wouldn't hold it against players, but
listen,
I mean, they've got the, yeah,
trades,
they might.
Trades have been vetoed or negated or withdrawn from based on a physical exam that revealed a lingering injury or scar tissue or something or limitations that a team wasn't aware of when they traded for a guy. Like, this does happen. And so this should be treated no differently than that. And, you know, yeah, if I were a player advocate, I would be saying, I don't want this out there either. That's their job. That's fine. But as a media person who thinks that more information is nearly always better than less, and as somebody who just is applying, like,
oh yeah,
but also even from a league perspective, the league should want transparency on this, because if somebody had it and it does impact their lung capacity or something else, when they are going to sign with the next team, it is absolutely fair for that team to know that, because just as they need to know that a guy blew out both of his knees or anything else, like, it's all part of a negotiation and the risk that you're taking on, what you're willing to do, what you're willing to say a guy is worth based on his track record, based on his physical condition, based on his age, all of those things. So hiding it, I don't think is justified.
Well, let's even be a little more selfish on this for a minute. And then, you know, I know we want to talk about other about this.
We'll talk about some basketball stuff in a minute.
Yeah, but selfishly on this, right? So I was at the Lakers-Nets game at Staples Center, the last sort of Laker game of the season, right? Or whatever we're calling it. And that is a game in which multiple Brooklyn Nets players, right, afterwards tested positive.
Yes.
And multiple Lakers.
Yes.
As somebody who had contact, was in close quarters with, even though, like, things were, you know, like, we weren't, like, in locker rooms per se. Like, we were in hallways next to players and coaches, on the court talking to players and coaches and stuff like this, people you know. This is still, like, social distancing was, like, we were in the early stages of that and stuff like that. You know, a lot of people were still not sure how serious it was. Like, I talked to a bunch of guys. I shook a hand or two.
Yeah.
You know what I mean, that day. Nobody told me about who had it, and I was kept completely in the dark.
And I think that's wrong.
And there was an anxiety. There was, like, a personal anxiety about that. Now, look, I'm sympathetic to the fact that, you know, as a player, you don't want a certain amount of, you know, your life public. But, you know, there is, like, again, like you said, I mean, if it was a hamstring injury or the flu or you know, strep throat or something like that, or JaVale McGee had pneumonia last year, like, we all knew it. Like,
yeah.
It you know, it wasn't
I don't understand.
This is a private health matter. Yes, I agree.
It should not be treated any differently than pneumonia, upper respiratory infection, flu, or anything else. As a reporting matter for the league, I don't mean reporting us, I mean the league reporting, it should not be treated any differently. The fact that they are doing this, I think, helps create the idea that there's a stigma around it. There is no stigma. Like, 3.6 million people, I think, worldwide have had this now, or I think just in the U.S., actually. I think 3.6 million in the U.S. have had this now. It's much higher than that worldwide. And 140,000 people, of course, have died of it. There's not a stigma attached. This is just a really dangerous virus. And it's one that we're all learning to deal with and live with. The NBA hiding it, shrouding it, because, and I think mostly because of player and union concerns, I don't quite understand. Moving on.
I mean, it's I would say it's clear that this was something a give, you know, to kind of make players feel more comfortable to come back and risk and play. But anyways.
Yeah, I understand that too. One other thing I want to hit before we get to Lakers and Clippers and the title race. Reporting came out a couple days ago, and I think we've all since confirmed that the NBA is, in fact, going to have the media vote on the postseason awards before the restart, before the eight seeding games. I don't understand why it took this long, and my apologies to NBA PR, because I should have reached out to have more of an explanation before I started recording this podcast. Sorry. I don't know why they waited this long, because if that was the determination, then we didn't need to cut it this close. I thought they were going to actually include those games. I think they actually should include those games for a couple reasons. But what do you think of the idea that the award race is over and that the eight seeding games that these 22 teams are playing will now have no impact on MVP, Sixth Man of the Year, Coach of the Year, Rookie of the Year, everything else?
I mean, I think, right, it's consistent with sort of the way that everybody's treated these games anyways, right? Like lottery odds are locked and different things like that. Like sort of like this is being viewed as sort of its own like living, breathing organism and not so connected to something that feels like it happened an eternity ago.
Yeah.
So and that way it makes sense to me. You know, it's funny hearing you talk about it now. It's like it does feel like if this was something that could have been decided, say, in May, maybe we would have had something to talk about in June. Maybe, we could have voted. Maybe people could have voted, and maybe we could be going into this and saying, you know, like, league MVP LeBron James leads the Lakers into their seeding games. Or, you know, Giannis Antetokounmpo. And we would know who these award winners are now. Like, I don't see the downside to that. Like, why? It's not like there's going to be so if this goes as planned, right, it is like a hose that has been pinched in terms of content for months that is going to just all of a sudden it's going to be scores, you know, stats, all of this different stuff from, you know, not just the NBA, from NHL, from soccer, from baseball, all of these different sports, the NFL and colleges, whatever. Everybody that's coming back is happening all around the same time. To me, like the MVP talk and stuff like that is just going to be kind of noise and all of that.
Yeah.
Whereas, if they had known that this is something they could have done. And you're right. Like, I don't have a great explanation as to why, at the LA Times, we don't vote. I believe, did you guys vote at the New York Times?
No, my 9 years at the New York Times, I never got to vote. I voted during my years at the LA Daily News, spent 9 years not being a voter. And then ever since I've been at Bleach Report, I have been voting. And as a voter, like if this had decision been made a while ago, I would have started really jumping in. And now we've got like 10 days for me to remind myself of everything that happened in March and sooner. So partially I'm just whining a little bit because now I have to figure this all out very quickly. Assuming I have the ballots again, which I assume I will, but I do think that this is a decision that could have been made a while.
I heard maybe you might get the boot.
I mean, totally justified, probably. I don't know what I did, but I'm sure it was bad. And apologies in advance to Tim Frank, because he's going to listen to this later, and then he's going to be pissy at me for not getting a fuller explanation. But here's what I'm going to say, Tim Frank and Dan Wyke. If it's unfair, if the idea is that it's unfair to the eight teams that weren't invited to not include them, or because they're not playing more games, and the other 22 teams get an advantage in the postseason award jockeying, I would say unfair to who? Because I look at this list of teams, Minnesota, Golden State, Cleveland, Atlanta, Detroit, Knicks, Chicago, Charlotte. I don't see any like really great coach of the year, MVP, rookie of the year, sixth man of the year candidates on these teams. Maybe a most improved player or something. Like who are we being unfair to by just excluding them? Also, these eight games are counting in the standings. The wins and losses are going on the record, the permanent record of the NBA. They will be there in the standings for the rest of eternity. They matter to the standings and the seedings. Therefore, they should matter to the awards because you can call them seeding games all you want. They are regular season games. They're simply regular season games that eight teams don't get to be part of because they suck.
Sure. I remember back on like October 25th or whatever it was when the Lakers played the Clippers on opening night in the first seeding game of the season because that game too also. Factored into the seating. I think you make a good point about it. It to me, like, you know, the names that come immediately to mind, right, is like, you know, is Devontae Graham somebody that people will consider for most improved player?
Sure.
I don't know that not playing eight games changes that that much. I think if you're committed to Devontae Graham and that, like, you're probably still going to go down that road. Derrick Rose is like sixth man of the year or something like that, or Coby White. If you view him as somebody you were going to have on your rookie ballot, like, yeah, okay. Like, I don't know that any of that stuff changes. I'm also kind of curious to know, too. I would say the counter is, like, do you think, like, as a voter, could something happen? Like, you know, knowing how, I don't know how you feel about this. I feel like what we're about to see in these next eight games is like a big giant shrug emoji.
And actually, to be honest, the basketball is probably going to be really bad for a while.
Yeah. So,
but still, but they count.
Do we want to assign value to that?
Well, the NBA is assigning value to it because they're counting in the standings. They're not exhibition games. They are regular season games that are going to contribute to a team either being in the playoffs or not, or being a sixth seed versus being a fourth seed. They matter. They may not be great games. The basketball may be really shoddy for a while, but the games count. And if the games count...
I didn't think you were going to say shoddy.
I could say shitty. We can curse on this podcast.
Oh, nice.
I was just trying to be nice. Right. I was actually just trying to be kind.
There you go.
It wasn't really about the profanity.
You're a mean son of a bitch, Beck. See, I got my curse word in now, too. No, I think, look, I'm sort of ambivalent to this because it's not really my problem.
I'll just say this. I know, you're not voting, but you'll write a column about what you would have voted for, sure. Right? Because everybody does. I mean, I look at things like this. Giannis.
Thanks, by the way. Make me feel like such a creative.
Stop it. Giannis is MVP, almost certainly, right? LeBron's number two. Like, those, that's the ballot for, like, a lot of people, if not the vast majority, right? But third through fifth, I think we're still in flux. And so when we're talking about Jimmy Butler, Joel Embiid, Chris Paul, Luka, Harden, Jokic, Kawhi, Siakam, like, I think it's fair that these guys in those eight games, depending on whether they get on a hot streak and can get their team moved up a couple spots in the standings and in the seedings, like, that should matter. And Coach of the Year... I think it's probably Nick Nurse number one, but Eric Spoelstra, Nate McMillan, Mike Malone, Billy Donovan, Rick Carlisle, Frank Vogel. Like, these guys, what happens in those eight games is going to matter in the standings and in the seeding race and could matter for Coach of the Year. We might see something in that time that says, you know what, I was leaning this way, but this tips it. Just like the final weeks of the regular season sometimes tip it. And that's really what these are. So anyway, I don't want to hijack the pod for like that particular debate. That news came out in the last few days. I don't quite get it. Tim Frank, yell at me later for why I don't get it.
Super off brand for you to be upset about award voting, by the way. Really off your brand.
It's funny because I'm one who says, like, it's just sports, like, just chill, people, whatever. And then, like, every so often there's this one little thing that'll just, like, for whatever reason, and it's usually awards. I don't know why.
I feel like we should call Zach Lowe just to get him in if you're going to complain about awards. Like, I feel like he has to be around for this too. It's contractual.
I've probably violated some part of my agreement with him on for the Lowe post. Let me be clear. It's not the biggest deal in the world. I find it a little curious, and I do think those games, if they're going to matter, they should matter for the awards too. Yeah. I don't quite get it. Tim Frank, yell at me later. Not that he needed any encouragement. Lakers and Clippers. So when we last left off, when we left our heroes back in March, the Lakers and Clippers and the Bucks, it was a three-way thing, but I think most people feel like the superstar twosomes of the Lakers and Clippers put them a notch ahead of the Bucks, and it felt like everything was going through LA. Now, literally nothing can go through LA. The title chase cannot go through LA because the title chase is actually going through Orlando, no matter how we look at it, which is a weird thing to say. Where do you think these two teams are with respect to each other right now? Because the Lakers had seemingly kind of surged ahead in the Gallup poll of who we thought was the favorite. Like, I started off favoring the Clippers early in the season, but when the season shut down, the Lakers looked, but all right, no Rondo for the time being, no Avery Bradley. The Clippers added a couple of people who I keep forgetting they have, like Reggie Jackson late in the season. They've got Joakim Noah now. Where do you think things stand right now between these two teams, these putative rivals?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's weird. Like, I actually kind of still feel similarly than I did maybe in January, which is sort of like, I still think I like the Clippers ceiling better. Just because I think I like the overall talent they have and the, like, on their roster and the depth of their roster better than I like the Lakers roster. But I feel like what I've seen, like the concrete evidence I've seen from the Lakers, makes me think that the Lakers are a better team. If that makes sense. And look, and part of this is sort of like when you have Kawhi Leonard and you have Paul George, like, working through shoulder injury and stuff like that, like, the Clippers were on a very deliberate, like, slow sort of climb on this, right? Like, they were pacing themselves, right? Intentionally. I think everybody in that organization would say so, right? I mean, that's just what you do when you have Kawhi Leonard, is like, you are building to a very specific star point, and everything you do is designed to get you to that star point. Whether it was a reaction to that or because of the way that LeBron James felt. People talked about him the year before when he got injured, or just when you put somebody as dynamic as Anthony Davis, who I think is the best player LeBron has ever played with, next to him. Apologies to Dwayne Wade. I mean, I'm sorry, the best big man, probably. You know, that's an interesting conversation, I suppose. But when you give him the kind of like a perfect sort of pair in a way that he's never really had, like in a rim runner and stuff like that, like maybe it's just the energy that that creates, like just shoots you out of a cannon, like the way the Lakers played this year, you know? And I mean, I remember having one conversation with LeBron about sort of this notion that, because I'm sure you would talk to people about this too, and they would say like, why are the Lakers doing this? Like, why are they going so hard? Right. It was sort of the criticism of them when you would talk to like scouts or executives about this. It's like, I don't know why this is a marathon. Like, why are you trying to set a mile record? You know, like I right out of the gates. And I remember talking to LeBron being like, I'm not like, you know, like I feel really good. Like I there's more there. There's more in the tank. And I think obviously the shutdown, you know, negates all of that talk. So I think the questions now when we look at these two teams is sort of like, who has the biggest question marks one game starting a week? And I mean, I think there are pretty big ones on both teams, right, Howard? I mean, you look at the Lakers, we mentioned it. You know, no Rondo, no Avery Bradley. Like, those guys played a lot of minutes for this team.
Yeah.
And it seems like, you know, like Kentavious Caldwell-Pope and Alex Caruso, and I'd love to talk a little bit about Alex Caruso, I think are guys that seem game and, you know, are in some of their better lineups and are impact guys. And I think in a lot of ways, like Caruso is sort of like a perfect player for the bubble. But I think like we need to see it. Like, we haven't seen those guys in greater roles. Like, we've seen this before where you take a reserve player, a guy like, think about it like a relief pitcher in baseball, right? Like, when you're asked only to get three outs, you can go throw as hard as you want every time you pick up the baseball. You know what I mean? If you've got to get 18 outs, you have to view things a little differently. And I think we've seen that with bench players in the past. And so I have questions about, you know, can Caruso do what he does in 18 minutes? Can he do it in 28 minutes? Can he have the same impact on games? Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
And then you look at the Clippers and you see a team that, you know, Montrezl Harrell left the bubble. He's not there. Like, he should be back, you know, but who knows what happens when you're out in the real world. You know what I mean? It seems like it's something, I think he posts on Instagram, something to do with his grandmother. And, you know, we hope everything's all right. But, you know, by the time he gets back, who knows? You know, Marcus Morris is, as far as we know, not there. Ivica Zubac, as far as we know, is not there. You know, so that's two starters. Landry Shamet has, you know, was somebody who tested positive for this and is in quarantine right now. He will join them. I mean, so we have four rotation players currently from the Clippers that are not practicing with the team. That, to me, when you're talking about this kind of a layoff, that's a concern. Like, you want to get as many reps in as possible. You want to try to rebuild your continuity. Ultimately, you know, are Paul George and Kawhi Leonard so good that it doesn't matter? Maybe. And I think the same maybe is true for the Lakers. But I feel differently. I think I'd feel differently about both teams if they were whole.
Yeah. No, and these are the things that we wouldn't normally be, you know, maybe we would be talking about them in a normal mid to late April as teams went into the playoffs and if they had guys who were banged up or guys who were dealing with personal issues.
I mean,
whatever,
we did it with the Warriors, right? The Warriors last year.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't that long ago where we saw a team decimated by injuries.
There's always some caveats, right? But these are different caveats now because these guys also haven't played together in months. So you throw that on top of it, and they're leaving, in the case of Montrezl Harrell having to leave the bubble, or Landry Shamet being positive for the virus. Like, there are different factors that we can't quite account for as they re-enter, as they go through quarantine, as we see how they're, you know, is Shamet, you know, how did he recover? Is he fine? Like, there's just a lot more, just many more variables, I feel like, and more unknowns in general. But let's turn to the Lakers for a second, because you mentioned this. So Kentavious Caldwell-Pope and Alex Caruso, those are the obvious guys to slide in and take the minutes that were vacated by Bradley and, for the time being, Rondo, who, if they make a deep enough run, Rondo may be back.
Yeah.
But the curiosity is going to be all about Dion Waiters and J.R. Smith for all the reasons that we would normally associate with Dion Waiters and J.R. Smith. We'll focus on them because of those names and because of their track records and everything else. Are we going to be focusing too much on them, or do you think Dion Waiters and J.R. Smith are actually going to figure importantly into what the Lakers do?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, every time I would have said 2 weeks ago that, you know, maybe, right? Like, these guys are fringy guys. I still think that there's room, maybe there are minutes for one of them there, right, at this point. But not to dodge the question totally, I the one of the things I am curious about is, like, does the layoff kind of help both of these guys who had no rhythm already, like putting everybody at sort of this base level of no rhythm? You know, can a guy like J.R. Smith catch up faster than he would if this is something where everybody's been playing, you know, every night, every other night for 4 or 5 months? Maybe that helps in this situation. To me, though, I think the guy is Caruso. And part of the reason, one of the things, like, we don't know a lot about what's going to matter in Orlando on the court, what's going to be different. One of the things we do know is there's going to be nobody there, and it's going to be sterile, right? You can talk about pumped-in crowd noise or music or any of the stuff that the league is going to try to do, whether it's home teams getting their home sounds or whatever, like Rick Carlisle said, so the Lakers having their organ. You know, it's saying dos minutos when there's 2 minutes left in a Heat game, whatever it is.
God forbid, please no.
Like the, you know, all of these things to make it feel like home. Like, you're going to have to create your own energy. And I think one of the things the Lakers lost most importantly with Avery Bradley is a player who created energy for that team with his defense. A player who would pick up ball handlers at three quarters court and set the tone for a defensive possession with just 5 or 6 seconds of intense defense, right? Like the start of a song, right? Like, I mean, you come into that with like energy and stuff like that. It's easy to see where it's going to go from there. And I think Caruso is a guy who does that. Like, he's one of those guys over the course of this year you would watch and you would say, like, I'm not quite sure exactly, like, obviously he's a very good defensive player, but like, I'm not quite sure exactly like what he's doing that makes them so much better when he's on the court. And I think when you don't really know like that, I think it's presence and energy are really the reasons, right? And I think he's an igniter. And in an environment where there's nobody who's going to be doing that, I look around and I've been trying to figure out who I think the players are on each team that can do that and who can do it in a situation where maybe legs are certainly going to be heavy, right, Howard? I mean, these guys haven't played competitive basketball in months.
Yeah.
So who are the guys that can kind of inject that caffeine into the game, you know? And to me, it's guys like Patrick Beverley, Alex Caruso, Montrezl Harrell. As we're talking about LA guys, I mean, I think Kyle Lowry is one of those players, certainly.
Yeah.
Like an energy, like a tough, just, oh my gosh, like you see that guy on a couple different possessions and all of a sudden I think it ignites something in everybody. Those types of players I think are going to be even more important than they would be on a nightly basis, because they are very important in this league. Yeah. Well, especially over an 82 game season. Maybe not as much in the playoffs, but I wonder in a scenario where there's just no energy, where you have to create it all yourself.
Yeah.
If those guys become kind of X factors.
Yeah. No, and you could totally see that with a guy like Pat Beverley for the Clippers. And the, you know what, the Morris brothers, and they've the LA teams split the Morris brothers evenly. Each got one, but there's a little bit of a question mark there too. So I mean, what do we know about what the status of the Morai at the moment?
I mean, we don't know much, right? I think the we haven't heard much on Marcus. On Markieff, I think the expectation is that he will be joining soon, but it's been pretty mum on Marcus, which is concerning, I guess. Right? It's hard to know. I mean, you're left sort of to speculate as to what it could be or what it couldn't be. Look, the Clippers traded a starter and a first-round pick for him, you know, and having him on the court is very important to what they do. He gives them tremendous lineup versatility, which is another thing I think is really going to matter, because I think the other thing that we sort of know, right, and I think actually both Morai have value in this to their respective teams, is that they're multi-positional players. I mean, look, right, like everybody's afraid of soft tissue injuries in this situation as people ramp up and stuff like that, that guys are going to get injured. So depth, I think, is going to matter maybe in ways that it normally wouldn't matter in a postseason. You know what I mean? There's a massive X factor, and you hate to reduce the coronavirus to that.
Yeah.
But, like, you don't know. You might be without a player for 2 weeks out of nowhere. You know what I mean? On a total fluke. And so having, you know, 11 or 12 guys who can do different things, who can play different positions. I mean, we talked about a little bit about the Clippers. Like, they have – Joakim Noah is the center that they have on campus right now, who has played zero games for them.
He has played zero games for anybody since March of 2019.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, they're going to have to get creative, right? Especially – and I think that's one of those things that you're going to see a lot of teams, I think, moving into that direction. Like, Rockets ball You know, I feel like I might see, you might see a lot of them, just because who knows what's going to happen. It's not like teams have a ton of big men.
Yeah. No, fair. When we started the season, and when I leaned Clippers at the time, it was a depth issue then. Like, even though depth doesn't always matter in the traditional playoffs because you tighten your rotation and all that, I just thought that, you know, the luxury of having a Lou Williams off the bench who can drop 25 on any given night, which the Lakers did not have that guy. The luxury of the Lou Williams, Montrezl Harrell, you know, 1-2 punch off the bench was something that I think the Lakers did not have. And I look at the depth now of the Clippers. I don't know how much these guys are going to play. Like, Reggie Jackson joined them late in the season. I don't know if Joakim Noah is really a factor. The Marcus Morris pickup. But you look at the guard depth. After, you know, Beverly having Lou Williams and Shamet once he's back, and Reggie Jackson, their top seven look really strong. I mean, Jermichael Green's in there. Like, we mentioned Morris. Like, there's just a lot. They've got a lot of useful bodies and I think more versatility than the Lakers, even before the Lakers lost their guys. So I still, like, there's a part of me that thinks LeBron and AD are so deadly and can do so much on their own. It always, role players matter. I'm the first guy to always say it. But in a situation like this where rhythm is out the door, chemistry's out the door, there is no rhythm, there's no chemistry, there's no momentum because nobody's played.
It might just be a talent race.
It might be, yeah. In which case LeBron and AD are this, like, wrecking crew that you just have no answer for. And Paul George and Kawhi Leonard can be that too, but not in the same way. But if depth does matter, and it is a matter of, hey, we need another guy to give us 20 on a given night, And the Clippers have that, and I think the Lakers do not. I don't know. I mean, I could talk myself in circles on this. And I think a lot of this, we really won't know how to read all these factors, the loss of momentum and chemistry and rhythm and all of these things that we usually talk about. We won't really know what to make of them until those seeding games actually start on the 30th.
And I'll even go further. I still don't know. I mean, if I were Frank Vogel or Doc Rivers, I wouldn't approach these seeding games all that importantly. I mean, right? Like, if you're the Clippers, you need to not be the four seed.
Yeah.
Like, right? Like, that is it. You know, if you're the Lakers, you need to not be the four seed. Like the advantage to playing, say, I mean, look, if it is, let's say it is New Orleans, right? That is the eight seed. Like, that, there's some reason to be a little concerned about, like, that kind of a matchup. Obviously, the Lakers would be the favorite in it. But, you know, assuming Zion Williamson is back, and, again, these are all big assumptions, but, you know, that's a pretty good, deep roster that, over a course of a series, like, if something fluky happened with New Orleans, like, I wouldn't be stunned. You know, if something fluky happened with Dallas, I wouldn't be stunned as a potential first-round matchup for the Clippers. Like, I mean, that's a team that has two tremendous players, you know, and I think... So the differences in all of these sort of, like, the matchups with no home court on the line, like, really in the West, I think, like, you know, 1 through 6, 1 through 7, it's hard to see how these teams are going to approach this. I mean, like, I asked Mike D'Antoni about that the other day, about with no home court, and he was basically like, look, like, we're going to do what our players need.
Yeah.
Like, emphatically, right? And I would imagine Doc Rivers for sure would do the same. And, you know, the way the Lakers have handled the regular season, it's hard to know, because they were definitely AD's got a sore ankle. Like, he wants to play. Like, let's try to let him play. I wonder if that approach will change now that, you know, I mean, the upside to being the one seed, to guaranteeing home court advantage. I mean, when home court is thousands of miles away, you know, it's not as an attractive thing. I want to throw one thing at you before we wrap.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you want to keep me for another 3 hours, when I stretch this.
I know you've got it in you. I mean, you can. You can go.
I could go. I feel it's been a long time, Howard. It's so good to see somebody and to speak to somebody. My wife is just like, shut up. I want to, as we talk, the flip side to me to the talent argument is sort of like, which team is the biggest pain in the ass argument? And I think it's like sort of like depth, relentlessness, mental toughness, all of these things that like who, what is the team that I think possesses the most intangibles,
like,
in all of this?
Like the team version of Patrick Beverly?
Yes.
Just a rambunctious, like, just a relentless pest.
And I think, like, the team that's most equipped for that, if that's the argument you want to make, is the Toronto Raptors. And I feel very strongly about this. And I felt this way. I sent you a link yesterday. It's funny. One of the last games I went to was Raptors-Warriors in San Francisco, mostly so I could have a second trip to San Francisco this season because there wasn't a whole lot of reason to go.
Nicely done.
And you know, it being in that building that night and you know, talking to Nick Nurse after the game and stuff like that. And you know, I was able to talk to Pascal Siakam a little bit, Norm Powell. One of the things that really stood out to me and kind of what I tried to convey in my column that day was sort of that this was a team that is like whenever an opportunity was placed in front of them, regardless of sort of how ridiculous or big of a challenge it would be, like they've just accepted it and just driven into it. Like, you know, foot on the gas, don't look around, just take it, right? There are more shots to be had. Pascal Siakam, Fred VanVleet, like Kawhi Leonard left this team, right? Like they replaced him with Stanley Johnson. Like this was a, you know, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson were the sort of the wing replacements for Kawhi Leonard, which on paper, no disrespect to those two players, but some disrespect to those two players, right? Like combined, like they can't give you know, anywhere near to what Kawhi Leonard gave them. And sort of just, but you know, Pascal Siakam's like, fine, like, you know, I'll take a massive step and I'll become a primary shot maker on our team. Fred VanVleet and Norm Powell, same thing. You know, OG Anunoby, same thing. More minutes, fine. Like, I'm good with this.
Yeah.
And this is what they did last year during load management, right? Anytime that team was in that situation, and this is what Nick Nurse has done his entire coaching career, like, put him in any situation. It doesn't matter whether it's England, you know, Iowa, for God's sakes, like wherever, you know. Do you like how much disdain I had in my voice when I said, oh, Iowa?
I just, you know, lost all my Iowa listeners.
Yeah, wherever it was. Sorry, McDermott's. Anyways, but yeah, so I look at this team as a team that's so equipped for it. There was a game early in this season in Los Angeles, and I remember having a conversation with Bobby Webster, the Raptors GM, afterwards, where they beat the Lakers this day, and they were outmanned. I don't think Kyle Lowry was playing. I don't think Serge Ibaka was playing, if I remember correctly. Maybe no Marc Gasol either. And there was a play where it was like a Chris Boucher, Norm Powell, you know, Terrence Davis, like 3-on-1 fast break. That goes as well as you would think. A Chris Boucher, Terrence Davis, Norm Powell, 3-on-1. Like, it went as poorly as that could have gone. Turnover, you know, Lakers back the other way now, you know, ready to go 5-on-2. It was like those three guys ran a suicide sprint, Howard. Like, where our seats are at Staples Center on the baseline, like, I've never noticed something like this before. Those three guys, like, almost all put their hands on the line and just took off. The other direction, Lakers don't score. The Raptors get a stop, come back, hit a three, whatever, game opens up. And it was, like, just a total effort play. And I remember talking to Bobby Webster that night being like, your team is a total pain in the ass. Because that's the, like, NBA teams don't do that.
Yeah.
Like, as a general rule. And I think, at least not all three guys. Two might get back. One might really get back. You know, but then, like, three guys to, like, all dig in like that, like, and come out of the starter's box, to me, it was like a jaw-dropping thing. And I think over the course of the season, a team that, you know, a lot of us expected to be maybe the sixth-best team in the East, the fifth,
yeah,
you know, kind of in that range. Like, that sort of seemed like their ceiling. I don't know. I mean, in a series against the Bucks, like, they have a lot of versatility. They have a lot of toughness. They're very smart. And they have, you know, like we said before, probably the coach of the year. Maybe that's what plays this year. Is a team that's together. Oh, by the way, and they also have the advantage of they're going to go into this. Like, they've been quarantined longer than anybody.
That's right. They, like, went to Florida early. Yeah, they had to go early.
Yeah. I mean, they've been in Florida since, like, I don't know, like 1997, it feels like. You know, they've been there a long time. So I think there's a lot of advantages for that team. Like, that's a team to me that's shown the most mental toughness this year. So that's, I am a Raptors stock owner, I would say.
Yeah. No, listen, I'm with you on all of that. There's not a single thing you said that I would disagree with. And on top of that, I've been saying all along, I think that, well, there's a couple things. One is, I've always thought that the East was closer than the records would indicate, that the Bucks have this huge lead that made it appear that they were just miles ahead of everyone. And they were, mathematically, yes. Mm-hmm. I don't think the quality of the team or their ability to make a deep playoff run is demonstrably, objectively miles better than anybody who's directly trailing them. I think Toronto has a shot. By the way, the Raptors, when the season stopped, were second in the league in defensive rating and tied for third with the Clippers in net rating. So the Raptors are, like, legitimately, statistically, they were right there. It's, you know, not record-wise, whatever it is.
And there's a big, but there's that big top-line talent gap, right?
Yes.
Where it's like they don't have a Giannis, they don't have a Kawhi or Paul George, LeBron or Anthony Davis.
Right, but at his best, Siakam was flirting with, not the MVP discussion for, like, the top slot, but at his best, the first couple months of the season, we're talking about Siakam on the MVP ballot somewhere, right? Like, there's a versatility and a talent there and a high ceiling there that makes you believe there's possibilities. Now, those possibilities may not all manifest immediately right now in 2020 in the bubble in Orlando, but down the road, we could see it. It may be too soon for that. It may be too soon for him to try to be Kawhi Leonard for that team to take them on that kind of run. But to your point, they've brought they have all these other weapons. They've got a Kyle Lowry, and they've got all this veteran talent that won a championship together, and they've got a still evolving Van Vliet and Norm Powell. Like, the collective there is really strong. So I think Toronto's in it. I think Boston deserves to be in the conversation. Yeah. I think the Sixers with a healthy Embiid and Simmons are the biggest mystery in the world because they're just such a weird team. But you can't dismiss them, and I'm not dismissing Miami. Like, Miami's really tough. And they play their butts off on. You talk about teams that you're putting in that pest category.
I was going to say, I was going to say, to me, like, they possess a lot of those Toronto.
You want a best of seven against Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo, just like screwing up everything you try to run, just this all out every play. Like, that's
Duncan Robinson shooting 70% from three.
it's a good team. Like, I think if I had to stake a claim, I'd say unless something happens. The West is going to be represented by one of the LA teams. There's nobody else I think is a serious enough threat if everybody's healthy. In the East, though,
Houston?
In the East, I think
what
it's all discussed. Houston's the perfect. They're scary when they get on a run because Westbrook and Harden are both so incredibly potent, and they do have some you know good 3-point shooting and defensive play around them. That if their defense is there, they've got a shot because those two guys are going to score a ton and drive you crazy. But that still depends on something happening. Like, the Clippers or Lakers really have to falter for the Rockets to beat them. I still think that's if the Rockets emerge, it's because something went wrong with those teams. They shot themselves in the foot or something else happened.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, I did this thing. It was very unscientific where, like, I sort of put together a formula based on, you know, net rating, strength of schedule, and then this other sort of category called, like, star points, which is sort of like...
Is this your Al Gore moment? Are you now inventing stats?
Yes. Yeah, sort of, right? Like, the general premise that is, like, in a playoff series, like, you want to have the best player.
Yeah.
Like, that matters.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And Houston scored very well in this, right? When you look at all-star appearances, MVP votes, winning the MVP, all of this different stuff, right? Like, they have two guys that can go win you playoff games almost sort of through their own sheer will, right? Like, two guys certainly capable of being the best player on the court at any night, not to mention kind of some other guys that could get just sort of red hot from three, which makes them scary. I think to me that the reason why I feel probably less bullish about a team like Houston than I do about Toronto and even maybe Miami and kind of like the sleeper categories is that, like, I do think depth is going to be really important here. And they are a team that is very committed to a specific style of play, right? And while that style kind of calls for versatility, you know what I mean? Like, what happens in a scenario where if P.J. Tucker isn't there to guard centers, you know, against you know what I mean? Like,
or the second Covington or Tucker is off the court, you
foul trouble. Yes.
Or anything, or just for a rest. The second one of their five starters goes off the court, you're already starting to wonder about what they've got left and how they're going to manufacture that same style and effectiveness.
Yeah. So I tend to agree with you. I mean, I think the West is certainly more top heavy in that sense, but I think it's sort of, I'm going to do something really professional here, Howard, to tie it all back to what we started to talking. Any good writer does at the end of a story, right? Like coronavirus this season, I think anybody who tells you they know anything for certain is a lie.
Yeah, we are all guessing. And I've been saying that a lot for the last couple of months. Every single, like, radio hit or podcast I've done, I've said, like, we're guessing. We don't know. We don't know what this long layoff is going, how it's going to affect people. We don't know how no home court advantage is going to affect people. We don't know how just spending your entire time 3 months in the bubble. Like, we don't know. Like, we have so many more variables, so many more unknowns, so much more weirdness than we've ever had.
What's the effect? What's the effect of, like, all this fishing going to do for, like, Luka Doncic's confidence? Like, you know, like, he must be like, Sky, like, that fish, like, that lake is so stocked. Like, you go out there and you do that, and, like, you come back with, like, 15 bass every day. Like, you might feel like you're on top of the world.
It's a great point. It's a great confidence booster right there, the fishing.
The golf will do the opposite.
The golf will wreck them all. No, I mean, look, it's just, it's all strange and different, and there is no telling how it's going to impact anybody until we actually see the games, which we will start to see finally 10 days from today when we are recording this. So maybe we'll get some answers soon, although I suspect those 8 seeding games are going to be messy enough that we still won't really have a feel for things until we get to the playoffs. But hey, basketball soon. It's on the horizon.
Good. That's exciting.
It is exciting. This has been great. Dan Wyke, thank you. Thank you for the added bonus of going outside during the course of the podcast, which we're doing on Skype, so I could see the palm trees that I no longer get because I left LA 16 years ago. Oh, look at that.
Look at that beautiful front lawn, Howard.
If you could only, now, you're not, if you really wanted to taunt me, you'd be showing me the ocean, but, you're not quite there.
Later. I'll send you a picture later. We did. We drove up by Ventura yesterday. Like, just did that, like, Highway 1 drive just because there's, like, you can't really do much. So you just get in your car and go somewhere. And, like, man, that's beautiful. Yeah. I hope we don't screw that up.
All right. Well, this has been great. Dan, thanks so much for joining me. Appreciate it. We'll talk to you again soon, my friend.
All right. Take care.